I'm your average action movie survivor. When I'm not busy trying to avoid massive superhero battles with people getting thrown through walls or dodging giant robots about to step on me, I'm listening to the Part-Time Fanboy Podcast. Be sure to check out Part-Time Fanboy at parttimefanboy.com for somewhat weekly podcasts and reviews about various fanboy-related subjects. Also, be sure to like them on Facebook and follow them on Twitter. Do it now, because the Robopocalypse is coming!
This is Part-Time Fanboy, and I am Christian Horn, and I'm here with my pal Paul Edwards.
Hello.
And we are going to talk about some comic stuff, nerd stuff.
Yes,
It's been a couple of weeks. Tell you the honest truth, I just needed a break. I needed to rest and relax and chill out for a while. I'm, you know, editing and posting and graphicking this thing by myself most of the time, and I just needed to pull away from it for a couple of weeks.
Yep.
So, you know, if you've been waiting with bated breath for our next episode, which probably not a lot of people are, but if you are, I'm sorry.
For all both of you.
All three people who are just waiting for our opinions on nerd stuff. But in the meantime, a lot of stuff has been happening, percolating, as it often does in the nerd world. And I kind of wanted to start off on a positive note. Like, are you watching Breaking Bad?
Yes, I am.
Yeah. I was going to start talking about Breaking Bad because I wanted to start off on a positive note. But Todd McFarlane and Mark Millar and who is it? Was it Jerry Conway or the creator of The Punisher, I think, was on that panel.
It was Len Wein.
Len Wein. Yeah. Sorry, Jerry Conway.
Conway was there, too.
Oh, he was.
Yeah.
Was he part of it, too? Anyway, I'm not going to call them names, but I almost did. But they laid the smackdown on women in comics. And basically, so what I was trying to differentiate when you and I were looking for the article just before we got on was, did they say that superhero comics are not for women or that comics are not for women?
Well, let's see. Conway's argument on this by the way, is on a PBS documentary called Superheroes, The Never-Ending Battle.
Yeah. Which I don't know when that airs, but
I don't either. But I'm sort of interested now to like sort of see all of this thing in context and figure it out. Although, I mean, it sounds really lazy and it sounds like a lot of bullshit to me.
Yeah.
Conway, the quote is, "Readers are not interested in those characters." He's referring to, you know, female characters.
Like all female characters?
Yeah. I don't know if they're necessarily, you know, saying that it's only superhero comics. Although, you know, honestly, if you're looking at American comics, for the most part, if you're talking comics, you are talking superhero comics.
Yeah, I think that's bullshit, though. I mean, that is a, if you're talking about American comics, you're talking about comics. I mean, that's bullshit, because I call effing bullshit on that, because. Okay, like, if you were specifically targeting just superhero comics, you might have a case. Like, you might have a case. But if you're saying superhero, if you're saying, like, just all comics in the U.S., like, in general, it's like, no. And that is not the case at all. And I've got examples, because I have a little girl who loves comic books.
Right.
Now, granted, she loves them because her father introduced them to them, but I mean, I can give you a perfect example. Like right now, she started first grade, and there's a poster that they have to do, and they have to put stuff that, you know, is all about them. Like what is, you know, talk about yourself on the poster. You know, they have to put pictures up, and it says favorite book. And let me tell you what she wrote. She wrote Bone. Okay.
Yep.
Meaning Jeff Smith's Bone is her favorite book, which is, she learned to read with Bone. She went through a phase only up until recently, for like the past 2 years, where everywhere she went, she walked around with those books in the car, reading them, carrying them around at home, sitting on the couch. So if you're trying to say that, you know, women or girls aren't interested in comic books, well, you're just effing wrong. You know, mm-hmm. And yeah, I would say that there is an argument for maybe that women aren't that interested in superhero comic books, but
it goes on to say that Conway's talking sort of about the history of the genre, and I'll read you the exact quote.
Okay.
I think it's a mistake to sort of like pigeonhole superheroes or add so much to superheroes that you're missing the fact that it's a genre within itself. That's like saying, why are there no medieval stories about female knights? Because there was only one, you know, Joan of Arc. It's an inherent limitation of that particular genre, superheroes. End of quote. So he's kind of saying that, you know, that there aren't women... basically, sort of superhero comics is not for women, you know. that because of the genre it is, that, you know, it's only going to be popular to men, and there shouldn't really be, you know, any kind of representation of women that's, you know, that I guess that it's expected to be sort of true to life, you know.
Yeah, but superheroes aren't true to life. I mean, comics are not always true to life. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Like, that is a load of crap. It just doesn't... Any way you parse that sort of quote, and, you know, if I were ever to meet the guy and have a conversation, maybe he would expand on that comment. But it's like... I mean, you look at manga, and there's stories about female knights, and the biggest reason for the manga explosion in the U.S., okay, these aren't U.S. comics, but they are being sold in the U.S., is because of teenage girls. I mean, it wasn't teenage boys that I would see, you know, at the borders, rest in peace at borders, you know, hanging out at the borders reading manga.
Yeah,
it was,
well, you know,
girls.
Todd McFarlane then goes on to say something to the effect of that he's got, I've got two daughters, and if I wanted them to do something that I thought was emboldened to a female, I probably wouldn't choose superhero comic books to get that message across because it's too testosterone driven.
Yeah. And that could, he could have a point there.
Well,
you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I guess what I feel is that it seems that this perspective is definitely only coming from the American superhero market. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and if you're talking about the American superhero market, yeah, you could very well have a point there. I mean, obviously there's stuff like Birds of Prey and you know, certain runs like the George Perez run of Wonder Woman.
Yeah.
You know, I think Peter David had a really good run of Supergirl. One of the best female superhero comics that I ever read was a miniseries called Batgirl Year One, you know. And yeah, I would say, okay, maybe you do have a case there. But again, you know, when yeah, that's American superhero comics, but that's such a narrow definition, especially these days of what comics are, that it just doesn't carry water, you know, in my universe. Because
and I agree. Let's say, you know, you've got someone like Gail Simone, you know, you've got someone, you know, who's a woman who's writing women and men, you know, and there's nothing wrong with that. It seems like they're focusing on sort of narrow, a narrow view of comics and sort of asserting that that's sort of the way it should be because that's the way it's always been.
Yeah, and it's not, because comics, just like every other entertainment, you know, media, whatever device, you know, has grown, and it's definitely growing, and it's attracting, you know, female readership like in droves because, yeah. You know, I mean, just look at, you know, sequential arts programs.
Yeah.
The last statistic that I read about sequential arts programs is that more women are enrolling in college courses for sequential art than men, yeah. You know, and that to me is fantastic because, you know, it just shows that an art form that, yeah, for a long time might have been just directly aimed at boys, you know.
Right.
Little boys. But then, you know, I can't even say that because if you're talking about the whole art form, I've got another perfect example, which is like when we went camping up in Northern California, mm-hmm. and we were at a supermarket and there were Archie comic books, like digests, on the
right.
shelf. And my daughter got to pick one out and did not pull her nose out of it for the whole trip. She did not want to watch videos on her tablet. She did not want to play games on her tablet. She just picked up that Archie comic and read it the whole way through. And from what I understand, Archie's like one of the biggest sellers in the country.
Right.
I'm not crazy about Archie. For a long time, I kind of veered her away from Archie.
What's your stance on Jughead?
It's not Jughead. It's the women in the, I guess, in the older Archie books, because it seems like it's veered away from that, where it just became about boy chasing, like where it used to be about boy chasing. It doesn't seem like it's that anymore. Where
Archie seems like they've definitely sort of opened their, you know, their universe. Look, even if you're going to argue superheroes only, I mean, look at what Brian Wood's doing with the X-Men right now. You know, you've got an X-Men team that's all women.
Well, and the X-Men has been mostly women for the longest time.
Yeah.
Even when I was in college and I was collecting X-Men, I remember I dated a girl and she was like, "What are you reading?" And I was like, "Oh, it's the X-Men." And she started reading it and she became a fanatic.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, obviously there is a case to be made for like body imagery and stuff like that, the way the women are drawn in comics. But then, you know, I mean, you're looking at things from a whole different perspective. I mean, look at the men in comics too.
Yes.
They are muscular. So I think it might have been McFarlane who said something about that. But the thing is that, you know, men and women's wiring, having been married for a very long time now, works mm-hmm. very differently. And where men are, you know, definitely more visually, you know, stimulated. So, you know, and women maybe a little less. I'm obviously speaking in generalizations, but I think that what a lot of women see as attractive is different than what we men think that women see as attractive. You see what I'm saying? Does mm-hmm. that make sense?
Yeah.
Because I specifically remember I have a very good friend who's slightly older than me, and she was into manga, and I was like, "Well, why are you reading this particular manga?" And she was like, "Oh, some of the guys are hot in the manga." And I was like, "They're all skinny. They're not like, you know." But she thought that the illustrations made them look really attractive. So, yeah.
Black and white.
Yeah, and black and white. Yeah. But, you know, I think that this train of thought is just so unhealthy for comics, especially when it's coming out of, well, is Todd McFarlane really a big creator at this point?
I don't know how influential he is, you know, these days, but, you know, the quote that I read that just cracked me up, some internet guy, I think his name's Reezer, said, Todd McFarlane's most famous female character was created for him by Neil Gaiman. And that's all I've got to say about that.
Yeah. I mean, honestly, there's really... I mean, it just leaves me flabbergasted when I hear about stuff like this and I hear about people with supposed authority. You know, I mean, McFarlane hasn't really drawn a regular book in how many years? I mean, he's so out of touch. You know, maybe Mark Millar is somebody that you could turn to as somebody who's successful, but really at this, and maybe was influential for a short time, but really are people looking at Millar as a writer whose style or subject matter they want to emulate? I don't know. If anything, at this point, he's kind of turning people off. And to say that Millar is incredibly influential, yes, his movies, his comics get made into movies, but if you look at the movies that they're made out of, they almost always take out huge chunks of the plot and terminate the tone of the original comic. Like, if you look at the comic Kick-Ass and you look at the movie, those are two completely different animals, as far as tone is concerned.
And it should be noted that the Millar thing is sort of a completely different thing than the other panel.
Yeah.
The panel that featured McFarlane, Lynn Wine, Conway, that's something different. The Mark Millar stuff came off of that New Republic article that they did about him, and he's just kind of like, he's just sort of being he's a chauvinist, you know.
Yeah.
It's chauvinistic, you know. It's specifically they were talking about the use of rape in his comics, you know.
Yeah.
And you know how it just sort of happens quite a bit, you know.
Yeah. Well, a lot of people have brought up like Alan Moore. Like, there's almost a rape in like every Alan Moore, you know, book that he's written. But the thing is, I think the difference between Alan Moore and Mark Millar is that Alan Moore shows that it is, he shows how horrific it is, and he can show the repercussions of it. Like, he will spend time like being like, okay, he doesn't, except for maybe League of Extraordinary Gentlemen. Yeah. Where like Mr. Hyde rapes the Invisible Man or something.
Yeah.
Like, it doesn't seem like Alan Moore is just like using it as like, oh, it's a horrible thing, I'm just gonna have it happen to one of my female characters. You know what I'm saying? And maybe Alan Moore gets a pass because it's male rape, although I don't think so. You know, but it's just, I don't know. Millar, I used to really like him a lot when he was writing the Ultimates. And then I remember specifically picking up Kick-Ass in the comic store and getting to sort of the second issue and just being like, I'm done with this, you know?
Yeah.
It's like, it just seems like sometimes he just pisses on his characters so he can piss on his characters, you know?
Yeah, I mean, that's the IO9 article that this originally sort of brought this to my attention. Anyway,
it's a great article.
By the way, a commenter called My Dear Peabody. It's a great one. And if anyone, you know, is listening who hasn't read this, it's a genius commentary.
Yeah, retort
on this. You know, her objection there is that, you know, rape is essentially, it becomes just a plot point, you know.
Yeah.
It's a way to create a sad backstory, you know, for your female characters, or, you know, a way, it's just, you know, that it does, it trivializes it, you know.
And
I suppose you could say the same thing about death, you know, that comics, you know, trivializes death in a big way. But I think that this is just something that's a lot more personal, and you know, Millar just seems to come off as a little bit, you know, sort of flippant about it. And I know that, you know, he, you know, part of it, you know, I don't know, maybe it's because he's, he sort of has that piratey kind of like, I'm going to, you know, yeah, you're just going to see how far I can take this kind of thing, you know?
Yeah.
And Millar usually, like I said, he seems that he uses these events to sort of see how far he can push things and be edgy rather than necessarily tell a good story.
Yeah. He uses it in service of story instead of exploring the issue any further than it just happened to someone. You know what I mean? and it's just sort of like surface material. And, you know, I mean, you can say like comics trivialize death, but like once a specific character, a comic book character is dead, you know, they're kind of out of the picture. If someone is raped or maimed or hurt, or they have to live with that, you know, and you can't just brush it off, and it affects everyone around them, you know. I mean, it could just be like, it's funny that you mentioned the death of the of a character, because it seems like it has become a trend in comics to sort of trivialize the most horrible things that can happen to a person for the sake of, I don't know, for the sake of like trying to build up a story. But you know, it almost seems like we're getting to the point of where, at least in comics and sometimes in movies too, just nothing has the impact that it should, because we're just so, people are just so using these as for shock value, and after a while you're just not surprised anymore. You know, or it just doesn't horrify you as much as it should, you know. I mean, so I don't know. I mean, I do know. I think those guys are full of shit. And honestly, yes, there are comics for women. There are comics for girls. You do have to hunt them down. Maybe the big two need to, you know, make a concerted effort as far as like reaching out. Like DC Comics, I'm stunned that they are not doing something with Wonder Woman that is in the line of like the Disney princess stuff. You know what I'm saying? Like, like you see like all the Disney princess stuff and how well that's pushed out and blah, blah, blah. And there you've got Warner Brothers consumer products. That's a gold mine. If you take Wonder Woman and you take like Black Canary and maybe Batgirl, maybe Catwoman, maybe not, you know, and you made a whole line of like dolls and put out product to support that and made them not like TNA comics, you know, maybe more of a manga look or whatever. That's a freaking gold mine waiting to happen. And they are just sitting there not doing anything with it. Because I can tell you right now that my daughter is very interested in Wonder Woman. Like, I think I showed, she's seen the Super Friends. And she's seen a little bit of the Linda Carter TV show. But I have not given her a Wonder Woman comic to read, because the older stuff that I found, when I look through it, it's like, oh, Steve Trevor, blah, 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 blah. And I call bullshit on that. And then the modern stuff, she's so scantily clad that I would never hand that book to her. There's a couple of children's books that I have gotten that are illustrated by Ben Caldwell, but they're a little harder to find now that they're not coming out on a regular basis, and I bought her one of those. But even when the Avengers was coming out, she's like, who's the Black Widow? Who's the Black Widow? And I'm like, oh, the Black Widow's one of the Avengers, blah, blah, blah. I want to be the Black Widow. And it's like, okay, well, why aren't we pushing that? You know what I mean? So I don't know. I really think that well, we've known this for years, that comics just has botched, you know, pursuing women. But that doesn't mean that there aren't, like, off the top of my head, you got Archie, you've got Bone, which I've already mentioned, you've got Amulet, which is a fantastic series, which my daughter loves. You've got I had another one on the top of my head and I can't the Disney comics from Boom. You know what I'm saying? That those came out. You can still find those. You know, I mean, there's like tons of stuff out there that is for girls, but it's just not being readily made available to them, or there's a stigma towards it. But that stigma should not exist anymore. There is stuff for little girls and for older women too. You just kind of have to find it. So, I don't know. Those guys depressed me. Let's talk about Breaking Bad.
Let's do.
Because it was awesome.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing.
I loved it. Now, did you go back and watch any of last season's episodes?
I did not.
Let me tell you something. I watched before this season premiere, I went on Netflix and I watched the last episode of the season before this. And I noticed something that blew my mind, and this is part of the reason why I love this show, because I really think And I have a whole other thing that I don't know if you and I have ever talked about in general, or if I've ever talked about on the podcast regarding Breaking Bad. But I think these guys like really think things through, because there's a shot, okay, when gosh, I'm blanking out on his name. The brother-in-law goes into the restroom, the bathroom, and the way they're shooting it is they're shooting it through the mirror. You see what I'm saying? It's a wide shot of the bathroom. He comes into the restroom. You know, he's just about to sit on the bowl. Hank is his name.
Hank is the character.
Hank is the character. He goes into the restroom. It's a wide shot.
Okay? The actor is Dean Norris. Yeah.
Yeah, and and it's a wide shot, but it's shot through the mirror. It's the reflection of the mirror, and you can see the whole room. Okay, so he approaches the toilet bowl, and he goes to sit down, and they flip it right around on him, and it's a close shot, medium shot, of him sitting on the toilet bowl. And I'm sitting there going like, oh my God, because he's just about to pick up that book, and he's just about to have his world just like flipped around and turned on his head, and just like there's no going back from that point on. And that to me is like genius. That they set up that shot, and I'm like, there is no way that that is a coincidence. And the reason that I love Breaking Bad so much, if it is a coincidence and I'm just making stuff up out of my mind, then that's pretty crazy. But to me, it wasn't obvious when I first watched it, but on the second viewing, I was just blown away. And I was like, and there's tons of stuff like that in Breaking Bad, which is why it's probably becoming like my all-time favorite show on TV right now.
Yeah, I mean, it really is just amazing how like beautifully put together the whole thing is. Even to the point where you remember the episode where Jesse killed is it Gail Bedecker?
Yeah.
You remember he was listening to that sort of like goofy little like operatic music while that was happening on?
Uh-huh.
Apparently that bit of music was about like the bald man. It's called Crapa Pelada, and it's all about a bald man. And you know who's the bald man, and it's our main character.
Yeah, Mr. White.
It's Walt. It's Heisenberg. You know, and it's just even like little throwaway things like that are just so well thought of that. I'm just blown away with the artistry, and it's the best looking show on television. You know, hands down. It's one of the best written shows on television, hands down. Yeah. And you know, just seeing what I especially love is seeing some of the actors in other things, you know, like right now the actor who we're talking about
in Under the Dome,
Dean Norris is Under the Dome.
Oh, he's doing a bad job.
it's a completely different show, but like when you watch Breaking Bad, you really see how awesome he can be.
Yeah.
And you know, and Bob Odenkirk is like, you know, he has dramatic chops, you know.
Yeah.
It's just so cool to see a show that like really sort of embraces like people.
Yeah.
You know, and like the duality within people, and like, you know, and how you're just, I mean, how horrible and amazing people can be often at the same time, you know. Like Bryan Cranston, you know, deserves like all sorts of praise on this, because you know, you've got a character who's just like, who does horrible things. He poisons kids, for God's sake.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you just have to admire like his tenacity, and like, I mean, even now in the face of all of this, he's still trying to survive. He's still trying to, you know, to make it forward. It's just like, it's such an impressive performance.
Well, it's interesting because it really, I mean, from the beginning, you know, Breaking Bad has really been fantastic because it makes you identify with a drug dealer or somebody who gets into the drug trade. I mean, it really, you from in the beginning of the show, you really understand like why he's doing this, because out of desperation, survival, he gets cancer and he can't pay the medical bills. And obviously there's a lot of pride involved because, you know, whatever his rich friends who tried to screw him out of or screwed him out of, you know, his company offer to pay his medical bills. But it's such a work of genius in that it takes the guy who's doing something wrong and makes you root for him. And it, not only does it make you root for him, but it makes you be pulling for him in such a way that it makes his wife, who has the rational and right way of thinking, the correct moral way of thinking, and it makes her just seem like an awful person for not understanding why he's doing it. You know, like, I can't stand his wife. Like, I, anytime she opens up her mouth, I'm like, just shut up, shut up, just be quiet. You know what I'm saying? Because you're rooting for him because he's fighting for his own survival. And at some point you're like, dude, I've got to do what I've got to do to protect myself and protect my family, you know?
Yeah. You know, one of the most amazing things about this show too, and here's, I'll drop my little pet, you know, theory on this. I think it's a great horror story.
Yeah,
because it's completely, you know, sort of an American version of Frankenstein. You know, he is the mad scientist, and he creates this thing, this, you know, amazing, you know, this meth that really then becomes, I mean, the meth is practically a character in the show too. You know, they're still talking about, you know, the purity. He's created this thing that he just can't get away from.
Yeah.
And he's released it into the world. And now, you know, here in this final season, you know, he's starting to reap the consequences of this thing. I'm going to be happy that they're wrapping it up, because it's going to be really good that they're going out on a high note. And, you know, they really are going out like all guns blazing.
Yeah. Well, have you noticed, and the thing that I kind of wanted to talk about, and I've had this discussion with friends and my wife, and you know, we started watching those episodes like all back to back, and have you noticed that each character has been assigned different colors during different times of the show?
Yeah.
Like, if you watch the show, there is such a conscious effort to make a specific character wear a certain color, or be, you know, be in a background that is of a certain color, and or just be surrounded by that particular hue. You know, like Jesse Pinkman, he starts off the show, he's all red, and then as he moves through the show, he wears a red hoodie, he wears a red shirt. He's all in hues of red, and as he moves through the show, he moves quickly to black. You know, I think almost right after the girlfriend dies, the goth girlfriend dies, and Mr. White starts off, you know, kind of like boring khakis.
Right.
You know
what
I'm saying? Yeah. And then he moves through different colors, and to the point of where now, he's wearing all cream, all white at the car wash. Both him and his wife. You know, when they're running the car wash, they are, in the season premiere, they are both in very light cream-colored clothing, which is what is white. It's the sign for purity, right? Like redemption. And then the woman who's trying to drag them back in, they only really shoot her from above, and what's she got? She's got black hair, you know? Hank's wife is purple all the way. You look at in the house, there's like a purple rug. She wears purple blouses. So that is like her color. So during the whole show, there has been particular color palettes added throughout the season and to different characters, and they change as the characters develop. And when I noticed that, that just blew my mind. And there is a level of planning and intelligence to this show that is just not there for other programming. And the fact that they're able to pull that off and do it with some subtlety. And I honestly think the only reason that I noticed was because when I started watching the shows back to back, I was taking a color theory class. And I was like, wait a minute. And it stuck out like a neon sign to me. But they all have had specific color palettes assigned to them, and they, and as they go through different emotional upheavals and stuff, the color palette changes. Never really too drastically, but it does change. I mean, it's pretty amazing, and that to me just says a lot, you know?
Yeah, it's a thing that, you know, I think a lot of people know about, and a lot of people, you know, probably, you know, don't get around to doing, you know, but it's like they just take so much care with every little piece of the show, the writing, the, you know, the set design, the acting. I mean, it's so rare to see someone do that, you know. I can't wait to see what they do with this.
Yeah, I'm all in. Honestly, if they pull off the ending in a manner that is satisfactory to me, I really do feel like this is probably the best drama on television, you know, if not of all time, in a long time. Because I don't think I've looked at one episode and been just like, ugh. Like, Breaking Bad has not really disappointed me, you know? And it just speaks to a level of quality that I am just astounded by. I mean, even this episode with Hank getting in the SUV and, like, almost driving. I mean, talk about an amazingly, like... I mean, is it subtle piece of acting? Like, it's powerful because he doesn't do much.
Yeah. It's subtle. It's like showy in a way because it's like so, you know, sort of big, but it also is sort of subtle too. And I mean, you see the quality of the directing there, you know, and the choices they make, the shots they make. And you know, that was Hank's second anxiety attack, you know. He's only had one other anxiety attack during the show. The other was in the elevator when he was interview with the, when he was moving up in the, you know, in the investigative field, you know.
That's right.
And, you know, it's like you really see, you know, the level that, like, this really brought to him. And I mean, Hank, again, every character is great, but Hank's one of those great sort of hidden characters too. You know, he started off as like sort of almost like a clown.
Yeah.
You know? Like he's just like, hey, you know, he's like the tough, like a caricature of a tough guy in a way. And like, as they've like brought him down and like peeled away all these different layers, you know, I mean, like Hank's sort of like the hidden hero of the show, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, have you noticed, isn't it interesting, because I was speaking to somebody at work where I was saying, like, it's so interesting how the roles have reversed. Like, when you first introduced to Hank, like you said, he was kind of like, oh, you know, the tough guy and, like, making fun of Walt. And, you know, Walt was kind of timid and quiet and stuff like that. And now, especially in this episode, you see, like, it's like, dude, Walt is in the power seat. You know, and Hank is scared for his life. He's the timid one now. I mean, he assaulted him, he punched him, but, and that final scene, you know who's boss. You know, it's very much like, hey, man, if you really don't know who I am, do you really want to push me if you think I'm the guy that you think I am, you know?
Yeah.
And that's just amazing. That's to go from the beginning of the show where, you know, because a lot of shows don't even get out of that established first impression.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? They just stick with the character the way they are. And this Breaking Bad has shown a level of growth that in characterization, in just plot development, in the things that people will do, you know.
And absolutely everything does develop the character. Every shot, even if no one's saying anything, it develops the character. And when they are talking, man, what great dialogue. I mean, this show has had some fantastic dialogue.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, it doesn't get much better than, I'm not in danger, I am the danger.
Yeah. you know? Yeah. Yeah, you don't understand. Yeah, I mean, that's And that's the other thing too, is that, you know, you're talking about dialogue, but it's not afraid to be quiet too. It's not afraid, like my wife said, she said, you know, it's not afraid to just let you observe something and just sit with it and just watch for a little bit and to take in and make your own assumptions about it. You know what I mean? So I just think this is like a work of genius, and I'm just like, I'm so impressed with the whole thing. I can't get over it, you know. Yeah. And just that final scene in that episode, I was blown away. Just blown away.
Yeah, this is going to be good. And I'm actually, it's one of those things where I'm actually settling down and realizing, oh my God, this is going to be good.
Yeah.
This is going to be, you know, a somewhat satisfying ending, you know.
So, what do you think?
Assuming they don't pull a Sopranos.
Oh my God! So you didn't like the Sopranos ending either, because I hated it.
I'm indifferent on the Sopranos ending.
Oh, hated it.
Yeah,
I'm one of the people that hated it. It's like, oh, I get what you're talking about, but I hated it. But so, where do you think they're gonna go? Because there's a part of me that thinks, like, okay, so obviously they're gonna come gunning for Walt, like the brunette, the sort of twitchy, first of all, like the really intense, you know, like his business partner, that woman that ran the distribution warehouse or whatever.
Right.
Like, right. You know that she's going to come out. First of all, I think she's brilliant. Like,
yeah.
I would love to meet her in real life and just know, like, are you that intense? Like, how did that casting process go? Because she's almost a little bit like over the top, but then you're like, I've met people like this, you know what I mean? Who are... Right. That like stressed out and intense,
right.
You know, so it kind of, you know, I can kind of accept that, but like, this is my thing. I think that somebody's going to go after his son. I have a feeling. I don't know, they're going to go after his family, and I think they're going to go after his son, because I think his son is the least likely character. That, you know, everyone is just assuming that he's safe, you know what I mean? Because he's so lovable, he's so charming, you know, you really do love that character, and he's so, like, sort of quote-unquote innocent,
yeah.
And he's so far removed than anything that Walt is doing, that I think that something is going to happen to the son. That's my prediction, and I feel that that would be the most tragic thing, you know?
Right. Well, the only thing that's sort of left to be seen at this point is what he's planning on doing with that gun and that ricin. You know, is he trying to take himself out, or is he trying to, you know, go to war and take someone else out?
Well, I have a feeling that we're going to find, like, because I don't know if he was just saying that for Hank's sake, but I think he was saying that he's terminal, that he thinks he's terminal. And I think what we're going to find out is that he's not. And I think, again, he's going to be surprised and be like, oh, man, I'm not terminal. You know what I mean? And then he's going to have to carry whatever's momentum is going on through the season. Because I think he thinks, like, death is his way out, that he's not really responsible for everything that's happening because he's going to die. And so what? You know, it's over.
Right.
And I think that's been a big part of the show, is that he can't really acknowledge a lot of the responsibility for what he does because he's going to die. And, you know, I think that if you know you're going to die, a lot of responsibility for your actions, you're just not feeling it anymore. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, that was a what's funny enough is that was the Frank Miller, you remember the Frank Miller Ronin comic? Yeah, that was like the advertising pitch for Ronin back in the day, was something like, the man who intends to die can do anything.
Yeah. And that's really right. That's a good segue, by the way, because I know that you and I both saw Wolverine.
Yeah.
With a the in front of it. And
Wolverine, you know, with a the.
So what'd you think?
Dude, I really, really loved the segment at the funeral.
Uh-huh.
And I felt like the parts that were like sort of like man on the run were pretty enjoyable. Overall, you know, it was you know, fine, but like that last third didn't do it for me.
Yeah,
Once it started becoming sort of comic booky and about like mutants and stuff like that, I was just kind of like, that wasn't as interesting as what you were doing before.
Well, the whole plot is nonsensical, right? Like, I mean, for anyone who's listening, spoilers, but, you know, I mean, come on, really? There's this Japanese businessman who wants to leech Logan of his healing ability, and so how does he do it? He builds like a giant, like, adamantium samurai so that it can extend his life, and he can, I mean, that's just that's not even comic book stuff. I mean, that's just bad, that's bad comic book stuff, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah,
like that's hacky writing. But you know, the thing is I kind of liked chunks of it. Like, I really liked chunks of it, but I think it really kind of embraced its sort of big budget action movie roots a little too much. I mean, I really, really just want to see, I want to see a Wolverine movie with a lower budget. You know what I mean? I'm not saying that this movie is bad, because it's not. I think I agree with you.
There were like huge parts of the movie that I thought were really fun.
Yeah. And let me tell you something, Hugh Jackman, you know, he's awesome. Like whoever takes on the Wolverine character after him is basically screwed, because, I mean, okay, like, Hugh Jackman doesn't necessarily look exactly like I would have imagined Wolverine to look. First of all, he's probably like 8 inches too tall, you know what I'm saying? Because Wolverine's supposed to be a really short dude. I think even shorter than me, you know? And I'm about 5'7", so I think Wolverine's supposed to be like 5'2 or 5'3 or something, and that's why he's called the Wolverine, because he's small and he's a killer and he's crazy. But I mean, but the biggest reason that this movie works is because of Hugh Jackman. You know what I mean? I mean, he picks that thing up and he carries it on his back. And, you know, I'll even go so far to say is the biggest reason that a lot of these X-Men movies work is because of him.
No, I agree.
You know, I mean, he really has made, I mean, obviously Wolverine in the comics has become such a huge character, even though he was never particularly one of my favorites. I was always a Cyclops guy, but, you know,
I was a Cyclops guy too.
You know, still, I mean, Hugh Jackman brings such a level of intensity and, a three-dimensionality, if that's even a word, you know, to the character, that you cannot help but love the guy. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, he has star power to burn, and, you know, he really does a great job of, you know, pretty much, you know, when he shows up, you know, he's always going to give it 100%.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think this movie is worth seeing, like, maybe on cable, or a rental, or, you know, if you feel like you really want to see it and you're a fan of the X-Men franchise or the X-Men movies. I mean, I went and I saw it at a matinee, like an early Sunday show, because my wife and daughter were out running errands, and I was like, I'm just going to go see this because I'm really curious. And, you know, there was a time where I was a huge X-Men fan. Like, I was right before, and it's really funny, because the moment I realized while I was watching The Wolverine, the moment that I gave up on the X-Men was the moment in the comics where they had it was like a big thing where Magneto sucked the adamantium away from Wolverine's bones, and then it became revealed that the claws were always there, and I was like, I'm done with this BS. You know, I'd kind of been so involved with the X-Men and reading as many books as I could, and just kind of being dissatisfied with like dropped plot lines or silly romantic things that never went anywhere, you know. But it was just that the X-Men were so cool. But I remember specifically that it was that moment where I was like, you know, I'm kind of done with this book. But there was a time where I was a huge X-Men fan before they became like popular like this, like they are now. So I don't know, I'm looking forward to the next one. I mean, not the next Wolverine, but the next X-Men movie. But I gotta say, those first two Bryan Singer movies, I've never loved them in the first place, you know? So mm-hmm. I'm kind of bummed that Singer's coming back. I wish the director of First Class was the one that was coming back, you know?
Yeah, I hear you. But, it'll be what it is. You know, they're trying to tie it all together. Yeah. And yeah, hopefully they're not trying to tie it all together just so that they can like wrap it up permanently or something.
Yeah. I mean, I honestly really, and I was hoping that X-Men First Class was going to be that when I heard about it, was that it would be just a reboot of the whole thing. And unfortunately it doesn't look like that's the way it's going to go. But you know, I am very much looking forward to I'm looking forward to checking out the next one, especially since it's based on a storyline that is just amazing in my opinion, Days of Future Past. I want to see how they pull that off. Anyway, I think that's enough for 1 week. How about you?
Yeah, I'm sure more stuff will happen, you know, in the next week. People will say something silly.
Yeah, I'm sure. Well, there's other stuff to talk about too, like comics we're reading and stuff. We'll see what comes up. This has been another episode of Part-Time Fanboy. Thanks for being patient with us as we took a little time off. And, you know, hopefully tune in next week where we'll have another episode where we chat about geek stuff. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, we'll catch you later.
All right.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Bye.
Part-time fanboy doing my thing.
I'm not doing part-time. I'm not doing